C1AN.
Number 2B.
But that still leaves people frightened. That still leaves people frightened. And that's what usually happens when one introduces the subject of animal magnetism to a student, to a newcomer, to a neophyte. If one is not very careful, that the student gets frightened. He says, all right, oh, there are two powers. I know that God is the only power, but if I am not very awake to it, then animal magnetism can have its trick on us. And he gets usually frightened. And that situation prevailed for quite a time in the movement. And I think even today, most Christian scientists are just frightened of animal magnetism. Because they have not gone further than this first edition, at the standpoint of this first edition, where they just become aware that there is such a belief, and that there is such a belief in evil power, which is called animal magnetism, and which has its effect on us, on our health, on our life, on our prosperity, on our everything, if one is not able to handle it. And to be afraid about animal magnetism is the only thing that animal magnetism asks us to do, to be afraid of it. But that was the standpoint in 1875. 3 years later, 1878, Mrs. Eddy brought out the second edition. And that second edition came out in two volumes. That is, she wanted to bring it out in two volumes. The first volume never appeared. Only the second volume came out in print. And on the cover of that second edition was Noah's Ark, picture of Noah's Ark. Yes, the second 1,000-year period broke on Mrs. Eddy Thorpe. And that whole volume is that Noah experience, that flood experience. It's a challenge between good and evil. It is a challenge between mesmerism and metaphysics. In this volume, she has a separate chapter called, at that time, mesmerism. Called it mesmerism. And what she wrote in it is really a big challenge, the warfare of spirit that she presents there between metaphysics and mesmerism. And the text is all under that tone of that flood of trying to pitch the ark so that no evil can enter in, to pitch metaphysics so that no concept of mesmerism can come into metaphysics and be incorporated into metaphysics, because she could see that many students at that time were mingling metaphysics with mesmerism, that they could not see the difference, as the second day always, the difference between mesmerism and metaphysics. And so her whole main tone in this second revision was all about this challenge between the two and separating the two clearly and purely, so that they could no more be mingled or taken one for the other. Right at the beginning of the chapter, she says that pioneering on a good cause is endangered by its foe. And you have the warfare right starting, the warfare of spirit. And she goes on and shows how mesmerists called themselves scientists and metaphysicians and vice versa, that they couldn't see the difference between mesmerism and metaphysics. I wonder how many Christian scientists today see that difference. Sometimes it seems that there are very few who see the difference between mind and mind. As long as they hear mind and thought and thinking, for them it's Christ science. But that this mind can be a human mind, a carnal mind, a mortal mind, a criminal mind, an apathetic mind, that doesn't come into their thought. And so here, Mrs. Eddy, in that second edition, she just fights like a tiger. Because they tried to put every blame on her. They tried to put the blame on all malpractice on Mrs. Eddy and said, well, you taught us that mind is power. You are the one, you are the culprit. You taught that mind is power, and if therefore the student and all those who read your book know that mind is power, they use that mind, and they use it just as they like. And if they use it for good, that's all right. If they use it for evil, well, they learn it from you. You know, it was an enormous challenge. And Mrs. Eddy just stood there, seeing that she has discovered one of the most beautiful and saving science, and suddenly found herself accused that she has discovered the most devilish thing on earth, that she has engraved, taken mind and shown now mind to the world as a power. Before, mind wasn't a power to the world. Before, only magnets and forces and muscles had power. And now she came and showed mind has power. But she meant something very different from what the reader and the student understood to be mind. She stood at the brim of a disaster. And so she fought like a tiger. So that second volume, you know, it is as if she would repeat herself sentence after sentence just to hammer it in, the difference between the divine mind and mortal mind. As I have said in the first edition, mind was always with a small end. There was no clear separation textually between the human mind and the divine mind. So she asked herself, well, that only that can mistake metaphysical science, which is either born of dishonesty or of lack of spiritual discernment. She puts quite clearly and says, now all through that second edition, it's always a challenge between metaphysics and mesmerism. She always compares those two. Says, metaphysics shows that mind acts favorably on the body, but it's mind. Whereas mesmerism is the control of the mind of the sick with error instead of truth. So she made that very clear first. She said, yes, through mind, the body can be affected injuriously. She said, but that she was unaware of the possibility that her system could be traduced in this way. And so she begins to uncover why it had been traduced. She says, she writes, the mental health practitioner putting aside our moral precepts. See, she goes down not to mind, but to morals. Putting aside our moral precepts retains that portion only of our teaching which relates to the power that mind holds over the body and one mind over another mind. Thus it is, by perverting the best method, he exchanges it for the worst and most fatal malpractice and mesmerism. And if through mind a person can be restored to health, the way is open for a villain to learn how to produce sickness through a mental malpractice with those ignorant of how to defend themselves. So you see how she puts that very clearly now. That she says, yes, the true metaphysician goes out. He knows that mind controls the body, but always to help and to save. And the malpractitioner knows that mind controls the body, and so he uses that mind to do evil. But Then she goes and says, but what is then the difference? And she says, well, the difference is that the true practitioner has a moral background, whereas the malpractitioner hasn't. This is a very important point, because that will explain us tomorrow the scriptural note for the present edition, that out of the heart come evil thoughts, murder, and so on. He doesn't say that out of evil thoughts come murder and so on, but out of the heart. She goes right back to the spiritual qualities against the animal qualities. To the spiritual qualities against the animal qualities. We'll see this point come out clear and clear in her writings as she goes on discovering. So she says, whereas in the first edition she only said, well, how can we protect ourselves from malpractice? In the first edition she only said that the community must be awakened to the working of malpractice. But here in the second edition, 3 years later, she says the community should understand how to detect the malpractice that lifts the serpentine head above common modes of evil. Unless restrained in its outlawry by metaphysical discovery, this evil would exceed any other past or present power to secretly work against the rights of humanity, justice, and truth. So you see, we will find in the second edition as we go on, first she postulates and says, it's not enough what I have said in the first edition, that the community should be awakened to the fact that there is animal magnetism at work. But she goes in the second edition a step further and shows the community should know how to detect animal magnetism. How to detect it. She leaves it for a page or two, but comes back then afterwards to it. Why should the community be instructed how to detect it? She says, because now the malpractice is done silently and no more openly by rubbing the head. And that was her newest discovery in this year. She writes that since having published the first edition, she has made new observations. Can you see how Mrs. Eddy was a discoverer? That it's not true that the whole revelation in its final form and in all its details have come in 1866. That's what the Boston people say, but it's not true. Mrs. Eddy doesn't say it so. A revelation comes in and pours on you, and you know it from your own individual experience that it is just a flood of light. And then day by day, week by week, month by month, year by year, that revelation becomes clear and clear and clear, and details fill in and fill in and fill in until finally, 1910, that textbook stood there as it is. And to see those spiritual footsteps is quite interesting, because it's practical, because there are spiritual footsteps which come to each one of us. Here, she says, she made a new observation that she has observed the crimes of another mesmeric outlaw, she writes, namely that the malpractitioner can do more evil without a sign than with it, without manipulating the head. And so she comes to hidden, silent malpractice where nobody can outwardly detect. And so she says, but how can we protect ourselves against something which we can't see and can't notice with our five physical senses? Every criminal who does a criminal act, he can be seen and can be detected, but how can a silent mental malpractice be detected? And that's why here she comes and puts forth this new step. She said, she speaks now of silent malpractice. That's new. She calls it criminal in the extreme. She introduces now in this edition the term mental malpractitioner. It's no more the rubbing of the head. She says that he can only be found out by metaphysical experts. See, He comes now to the point of finding out this silence, this hidden mind. She says she considers mental malpractice more criminal and dangerous than manipulation, because the mental malpractitioner has a chance to escape detection through a silent malpractice, naturally. And you see, we have here already the first indications of the sixth subject in the chapter tomorrow. Then, she says, therefore, her metaphysics, she says, is not responsible for malpractice. Says, metaphysics teaches how to do good through a mental process, how to benefit mind and body. And the metaphysician is incapable of foul malpractice. Whereas the malpractitioner cannot say he learned of us how to malpractice, when we never knew how this abuse of metaphysics was done until we saw that it was done. You see how she fights for her reputation to be a discoverer of a mind science which is spirit, which is good, whereas it was traduced as a mind science or a mind cure, which is evil. Because the common denominator was the term mind. But she understood under mind something very different what the malpractitioner understood. Because that was not yet made clear in her textbook. And so she comes back to the main point of this, where she has said the community must learn to detect the evil mind. That only the metaphysical expert can detect it. But how? And so here for the first time she gives now that clear cut. See, that second day, that firmament, and makes a clear cut between divine mind and mortal mind. She states here that in this year, 1878, she has arrived at the following point of discovery. And so for the first time she mentions divine mind and puts divine in capitals, capital F, not mind. And she wanted to express the divine mind, which we have mind with a capital M. At that time, the D of divine was capitalized. And she says that whoever practices metaphysical healing through which the divine mind pours in upon the aged light and healing cannot malpractice. See, she says now, if the source of the practitioner is metaphysic, namely the divine mind, then it is impossible, even if he would, to malpractice. He can't malpractice. Through this method, she goes on to say, the individual who does evil and the evil intent will be found out. Will be found out. And the thoughts, the motives, and the fears that mortal mind embrace will become as apparent to mind as a material object is to personal sense. See, we get here now the divine mind reading, which we had last time in as now a big subject in spiritualism. You remember in the second part of spiritualism, in the tone of principle, she deals with divine mind reading versus mortal mind reading. And then we had that wonderful part of principle as truth, where she shows how divine mind can uncover all the hidden and unknown, the unconscious mortal mind. And we have seen last time how that is really the pith of John Dawley's practice book. That his whole practice book rests on that method of reading the error, of discovering and detecting the error that needs to be destroyed through divine mind reading. And we have seen how Mrs. Eddy, in that part of principle as truth, has the same order as Mr. Dawley has given in the chapter on, in his book on practice. Here, for the first time, she touches that. In the second edition, she began to see that only a that only the divine mind can detect the ways and means and modes and purposes of mortal mind, the intent of mortal mind and the malpractitioner. And then, to defend herself even more, she says, when the ability of mind to detect what mind is doing becomes more general, it will be all that is required for self-protection. So she ends that not quite the end, but comes towards the end of that second edition, where she shows that that which helps us to detect and protect ourselves from any form of malpractice, from the power of malpractice, the ways of malpractice, the hidden arguments of malpractice, is by going back to the divine mind, staying in the divine mind, and that divine mind, which is the all mind, by the law of opposites, will always protect us, because it will always uncover in time and in the right measure and in the right place what is at work evilly. Well, that's more or less the main points of this second edition, which would show us up to now what? Which would show us up to now that just as it is for us, that it was for Mrs. Eddy, a surprise, that if we are studying truth, God, and if all our heart is devoted to a good purpose, that suddenly we are faced with a foe, animal magnetism. The belief that there is something beside this one God, that there is a power beside the power of good and our good intention, that something can stand in the way. That was quite new to Mrs. Eddy. She was taken by surprise. And what is her answer? Her answer is to handle animal magnetism. How? In the first edition, she only handled it from the point of view of mind. She handled it from the point of view of mind, which we still have to handle from the point of view of mind, which says you can't be blind about beliefs, about animal magnetism. You must be aware that unless we stay consciously and consistently and always in the realm of the divine mind, that mortal mind has a chance to creep in, and that we have to know the ways and means. Even as with Mrs. Eddy, we don't like to investigate it, we should do it on God's command. Then, in our second edition, he shows that we have to handle that whole proposition of animal magnetism from a still further point, namely that we have to see that only by resorting to that mind which is spirit, to the divine mind, we can really be separate from mortal mind. And that there is no mingling between the human mind and mortal mind. Therefore, if we stay in the realm of the divine mind, we will always do good. We can never do something evil. But the moment that we let go of the divine mind, we fall back into that mind which believes in good and evil. The serpent, which is the knowledge of good and evil. And so our protection in the second stage of development is that we fill our thoughts with the spiritual and moral qualities of good, and that is a protection for us.